The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Reyes, and Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding. The first case before the court this morning is A21-1517, State of Minnesota versus Keith Melvin Berg.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's May 26, 2022. We have six matters on our calendar this morning, three of which are oral arguments, which we are, as you know, conducting via Zoom.gov this morning. The rules on Zoom.gov, as I believe both of you know, are really the same as they are in our physical courtroom, are very close. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are recording these oral arguments and posting them on our website, so please introduce yourself the first time you speak both times so that people are able to identify who you are and who you're representing if they listen to those oral arguments. I don't anticipate any, but if you encounter any technical difficulties this morning, please let us know because we'll put things on hold, try and help you because we certainly want to hear all of what you want to share with us this morning. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, this is attorney Jacob Burkholz representing appellant Keith Berg. I think the facts are relatively clear, but in this case, Mr. Berg had a Norgard plea, been on probation, and had a probation violation. I came into the case at the trial court level, and I'm also as appellant counsel, where he had a contested probation violation hearing on a single violation that he was alleged to have failed to complete treatment and was then discharged. And so the court then executed his sentence and sent him to prison. And so what issues for this court do we feel are appropriate for appellate review? And first of all, that Mr. Berg, who had a relatively minor violation, but previously that he drank some alcohol. No alcohol was involved in this violation, and he was actively enrolled in core treatment. And so the challenge I have in this case, in many cases, and I think in part we can start with the due process argument that Mr. Berg was not on adequate notice. So he wasn't alleged to have committed a crime. And I think that Minnesota law and other cases require then that if it's not a crime to independently commit the violation, then there has to be some actual and definite notice of the lawful conduct that would then trigger the violation. So that's the challenge that I have in this case. What did Mr. Berg actually be on notice for that he violated? And so the only violation is that he didn't complete treatment. And so he was discharged because of lack of progress. Now, I think the testimony at the trial court level from the therapist who was one of the treating therapists at CORE gave some questionable testimony. It went back and forth, in my view, in the record as to her believed basis versus the letter.
So, Mr. Burkholz, if I could... Yes. Interrupt, because I think you hit on what I thought was kind of the key question here is what was he supposed to be put on notice of? And you said that he had a complete sex offender treatment. He was terminated from the CORE program. So if he was terminated from the program, he did not complete sex offender treatment. So That seems pretty straightforward and fairly clear that that's what was expected of him and that's what his violation was, is he did not complete the sex offender treatment.
There's a couple layers to that, Your Honor. You can't be on notice of something that you're given after the fact, right? So if he's discharged, he never knew it would discharge him. The only way he could not complete is if he's discharged. So what happens then is he's prevented from doing the task simply because he's given notice of the lack of progress letter. So he was never on notice on what would actually create the discharge. And so that's the challenge. He goes to his meetings, and there's extensive testimony on this, and tried to lay that out as clearly as possible, because I think when you look at the actual facts versus the testimony, Ms. Andrea's letter was a bit of the discharge was very misleading in the sense that he had not missed or failed to actually do what was asked of him in treatment, but for failure to bring his homework. He was actually doing remote hearings and then didn't present adequately. And this is part of that notice problem. So I don't think it's a simple argument that what ends up happening, to go down your argument, Your Honor, is if it's simple, then a therapist can discharge you for any reason at any time for their own opinion and then be violated because you can't complete and never be allowed to complete. And that's why I went back to Alpha Emergence and brought in an expert in this case so we could deal with this argument. And the argument is he can do and was doing a sex offender treatment program at the time he was violated. And so
if I may, I would be more persuaded by your argument if he hadn't signed it, which I understand he did, a treatment agreement. Didn't that treatment agreement, tell him, you're going to have to take this polygraph and something about assignments? I mean, I thought at least the broad parameters were set out. Well, if you could help me with that then.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's not in the record that I'm aware of, that his detailed allegations or what is it testified to about. They do generally sign some sort of treatment program contract. I don't disagree with that. And I think Coors is fairly burdensome, but I think they even attempted to violate him for not paying $300. That was their contract. They ended up not pursuing the violation in court and then reinstating him on the program prior to this situation. But there's nothing that I could see in the record, nor the letter, nor the testimony for Your Honor to make that argument, right? The state did not present a contract he signed, did not present testimony that he clearly violated what he should have been on notice for. Would have been a more interesting case. But I don't think there's anything in the record that would allow this court to make those arguments that he was on notice of. And I highly doubt that exists in this case. For example, if Your Honor was correct, that you're required to do your homework. So what does that mean? If you miss one homework session, are you then terminated? That would have to be laid out very clearly in the treatment program contract, which he would have then had to sign to go into court. And I think there was maybe some unpublished case that referenced that possibility and that was in the record in that other case, which was he did sign a very clear contract and the state did make that argument and the court found he violated it. That didn't happen. So this court's left with not only an absence of evidence, but then the trial court, Judge Ferrazano, never had that to make findings on. So I don't think it would be appropriate for this court to make findings on a fact that didn't exist. Might have existed, but wasn't in the record. So again, it goes back to this underlying issue of what was he on notice to do or not do? And also,
and I just want to follow up on that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't he acknowledge that he would be required to successfully complete treatment for his conduct underlying the offense and that his failure to complete treatment could result in civil commitment, jail time, or both?
You're talking about the underlying transcript at the sentencing hearing?
I thought he acknowledged that he knew that he had to successfully complete treatment.
I'm not aware of that clearly. I know that was in the sentencing order that he needed to complete treatment, but I'm not sure if.
Well, he was told by the district court judge that he needed to complete treatment. Is that what you're saying?
I'm presuming that was in the original sentence that was issued in this case prior to my involvement. I don't have the transcript handy, but.
So if he was told that, then defendant has to be there at their sentencing. So he was aware of that at that time then, correct?
I don't think there's a fundamental dispute that he needed to complete treatment at some point.
Well, but I think one of the key, if I am understanding you correctly, is I think you're alluding to the idea that he didn't know what he needed to do. But I think the fact that he was told at sentencing that you need to successfully complete treatment, isn't that sufficient notice to put him on what he needs to do? What he needed to do?
No.
So the district court judge telling a defendant, you need to successfully complete your treatment, and failure to complete that treatment may result in incarceration, civil commitment, or both. That's not enough?
Correct, because the Austin factors and due process require that someone be on notice to be intentionally and willful in their probation violation. So
I think that's a separate issue, though, in terms of, you know, whether how is him being told that? How does that show he didn't know it? I think that's why I'm struggling with your argument.
Sure. And I think it's because the conduct's lawful. And I provided that in my reply brief, that the conduct must be actual and definite, clear notice when the conduct is lawful, meaning it's not unlawful to be in sex offender treatment. It's not illegal to do sex offender treatment nor participate in sex offender treatment. And there is no clear Minnesota case law on this, and I'm asking this court to make some, in that there be provide actual clear notice to a sex offender who's in treatment as to what conduct within that lawful course of behavior would trigger a discharge or lack of completion. And so there isn't any. And so if then your lawful behavior, such as obey all laws, I referenced that in the reply brief of, well, can you just simply say you must complete it? Therefore, the keys to the entire courthouse, meaning the probation violation, is handed to the treatment provider to do whatever they wish.
Are you asking us to create new law? Because that's not our role. We're an error correcting court.
No.
So is there any case law you can cite to in support of your proposition then?
Clear binding? Absolute no, not from Minnesota. So that's why I provided this court some other law, both and also from the U.S. Supreme Court. I guess that's binding in this court, such as the U.S. v. Simmons and Chapel. I guess those are other circuit courts, and I don't have every reference from within those courts where they say, no, you have to look and say, well, what exact behavior will trigger, such as the case from the Morstead v. State from North Dakota, that whether or not he had actual, clear, definite notice that his failure to admit guilt as part of treatment would constitute a violation of probation. And I think that is kind of getting to the heart of this case as to what was the notice of, what was he not doing? And so there's a slight mixture in the facts of, well, he didn't admit enough. I spent extensive time on crossing, well, because it was a Norgard plea, that if he's not admitting enough, then you're going to violate him. And I make very clear that that was always present in the case from 2018 through 2020, all the way through this violation hearing, and she never had a problem with it. In fact, multiple times, Ms. Andrea, the therapist, says, well, I don't really have a problem, but I don't think you're making adequate progress. And then she changed her mind a few times and says, well, he's not really doing his homework. And I said, well, that isn't really true either. In fact, he was there and present for all of them. And we went through each and every time when he was reinstated on probation from January through May, that he only wasn't. In fact, he had actually done his homework and his assignment the day of or the day prior to his violation.
So, Mr. Burkholz, if I may.
Yes.
So what I'm hearing you say is you agree with the idea that the district court made clear that he had to complete sex offender treatment at some point. The question then is, what are the requirements of each treatment program that he might have entered to successfully complete or just complete, since completion in and of itself would be successful? I have some concerns that perhaps you're asking district courts to step into the shoes of the treatment providers to say what constitutes completion for their specific programs. And the reason why we send them to those programs is because the people who are treating them are the experts in that field. So can you explain to me where that line is between what the district court should order and what is in the realm of what the treatment provider determines?
That's a great question, right? And in essence, I think the challenge becomes, well, then does the contract for a sex offender that they sign have to be part of the sentencing order? That would be ideal, right? That the actual requirements that they need to complete to be violated would be clearly put to the probationer. And I think that's the constitutional requirement that when you're engaging in lawful behavior. So the real challenge, Your Honor, I think you ask is what I've been dealing with in lots of cases, including this one, is, well, the district court judges say, well, I'm not going to second guess the treatment provider. But when I actually cross-examine the treatment provider, she didn't actually make the decision. If you look back, she had a secret meeting with some of her advisors, and they decided to come up with a vote, a closed room vote to discharge him on a concept of lack of progress. And I think to tell the court that, well, what's the right method? I know that CORE, which is why I brought in Alpha Emergence, has a vastly divergent view on how to deal with Norgaard's and Alford pleas. And I think what's happening, at least in our district, fifth and the related areas where we have CORE and Frank Robert Weber's program, they're authoritarian model. You don't comply, you're kicked out. And that's very problematic. And that's exactly what happened in this case. If you don't do exactly what we say and when we say it, you'll be voted out with no guidance to the probationers when they have clear willingness to participate, clear willingness and continued efforts and desires to complete treatment, available time on treatment. They're not absconding. They're not being willfully lack of participation. But I understand the problem of saying, well, how do we deal with it? Is it a due process issue? Or do we just say that it was a failure of lack of notice within the sentencing order? Or is this really an Austin issue, right? That they're just not an adequate elements. So I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Buchholz. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Smith, we'll turn to you.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I'm a special assistant Watonwan County attorney representing the respondent state of Minnesota in this appeal. I want to hit on a point that Judge Wheelock touched on. Appellant's proposed rule, to the extent that he has one, would require district courts who lack the professional competence to do so to micromanage treatment programs of all stripes. Chemical dependency treatment programs, sex offender treatment programs, various and sundry other mental health treatment programs. And so appellant is asking this court, as a matter of new law, and quite frankly, in a way that no court has ever required, whether in Minnesota or across the country that I can find, to require district courts to substitute their judgment for what constitutes adequate progress in treatment for that of treatment professionals. But that's not what the law requires. What the law requires is that the defendant be on notice of the requirements of their probation. And the clear requirement of appellant's probation was that he complete as directed by his agent. That condition is adequate. He's on notice of what conduct will result in a violation of his probation. Failure to complete treatment.
Mr. Smith, at least doesn't kind of what Mr. Buchholz's argument come into play when the court should be looking at the second Austin factor. So was this violation intentional or inexcusable? Well, if the rules of the treatment program weren't clear, doesn't it squarely go to that issue? And I ask this because all the district court says about that is defendant knew that homework needed to be completed and progress needed to be made in order to be successful. And is that really the examination we want of whether someone's violation is inexcusable and intentional?
I think it's certainly relevant to the question of whether it's intentional and inexcusable. And to your earlier question to appellant's counsel, the record does actually reflect the fact that the expectations of the treatment program were made clear to him when he entered during the intake process. And I set forth the transcript citations at length on page 6 in the facts, but I can direct the court to some specific transcript pages now if the court desires. But what he did have to do was sign a treatment agreement. That agreement put appellant on notice that he could be terminated from treatment if he denied the offense for which he was ordered to complete treatment after failing a specific issue polygraph. And to Judge Reyes's question, appellant was already on notice of that fact from the Norgaard addendum, which he signed and which was filed and which was available. And in that addendum, one, he acknowledged that he made no claim that he was innocent of the offense to which he was pleading guilty. Two, he acknowledged that if he would be treated the same as if he had provided a factual basis by admitting on the record that he committed each element of the offense for purposes of treatment, and that he would be required to complete, could be required to complete treatment, and that failure to complete treatment could result in the revocation of his probation. All of those things are set forth in the Norgaard addendum, which he went through with his attorney at the time of this plea, which he signed and which he, I presume, because appellant makes much of the fact that this was a Norgaard plea, but didn't request a copy of the plea transcript. So to the extent that he relies on arguments that would come from that hearing, and that the defendant, the appellant's statements might risk an admission might risk the specter of a perjury prosecution, he's failed to provide an adequate record on that issue. But the Norgaard addendum is in the record for the court to view, and it addresses all of those things. And moreover, the treatment agreement put the appellant on notice that he could be terminated from treatment if he fell behind in his payments. And in fact, he was terminated from treatment once for falling behind on his payments and was allowed to restart. And a violation wasn't filed at that time. Finally, his treatment provider put him on notice that he was expected to have treatment assignments completed and ready to present for every treatment session because he couldn't make progress unless she could review his assignments. That was all done during the intake process. It was all testified to at the contested revocation hearing. Transcript pages 21 through 23, 30, 32, 39. The record is there. There's no issue with the record. There's no issue with the district court's conclusion that the appellant knew what he had to do to complete treatment, and he failed to do it. With regard to, I want to discuss a little bit the foreign cases, particularly Morstead versus State out of North Dakota. First of all, as far as I can tell, and as far as the Supreme Court of Tennessee could tell in 2018, no other jurisdiction has ever adopted anything remotely resembling the Morstead rule. And the Morstead rule is actually fairly unique to its particular facts, I think. The defendant there did not plead guilty. He was convicted following a bench trial. At sentencing, the district court's comments suggested to the defendant that his probation was not contingent on admitting guilt as part of the as part of sex offender treatment. Moreover, North Dakota's law regarding probation violations is fairly unique and is not the same as Minnesota's law. They, in fact, provide that conditions of probation are strictly construed in favor of the offender. Minnesota law doesn't have such a provision. In fact, I would analogize that to basically lenity. It's the principle of lenity applied to probation violations, and neither the Supreme Court nor this court has ever adopted such an approach. So it is unique to North Dakota, I think, and it's also unique to the particular case there where the defendant was affirmatively led to believe by the district court that failure to admit guilt as part of treatment wouldn't be a basis for revoking his probation. Appellant also cites a couple of Florida cases, Lawson and Adams. First of all, Lawson is not a sex offender treatment case. It's a drug treatment case. And that case did hold that notice required by due process does not require district courts to set a deadline or set a number of chances that a defendant has to successfully complete treatment. In Adams, the Supreme Court of Florida applied that rationale to sex offender treatment. But a more interesting case is Staples versus State, 202 Southern 3rd, 28 out of Florida in 2016. And there, the Supreme Court of Florida rejected exactly the approach that appellant would have this court adopt. In fact, Florida's intermediate courts of appeals, which are district courts of appeals, had created a conflict where they were requiring the district courts, some of the districts were requiring the trial courts to make very specific requirements of a sentencing order. And the Supreme Court of Florida rejected that approach and said, citing Lawson, actually, that probation orders need not include every possible restriction, so long as a reasonable person is put on notice of what conduct will subject him or her to revocation. And then, although conditions should be clearly set out and must mean what they say, every detail need not be spelled out, and the language should be interpreted in its common and ordinary usage. So again, what the Supreme Court of Florida is saying is makes sense in this case. You look at the facts of the case and see if the facts demonstrate that the appellant knew what he needed to do. And the treatment agreement demonstrates that appellant knew what he needed to do to complete treatment.
Mr. Smith, given our limited time, if I could turn your attention to something the Minnesota Supreme Court has talked about a lot, which is the third Austin factor. And I just see very, very little discussion in this record comparing the confinement versus the policies favoring probation, which I find particularly troubling in light of the fact that there was an alternative treatment option, you know, that was clearly put forward. So tell me, why shouldn't we be reversing remanding for the court to take another look at that?
I think on that question, if you look at the transcript of the disposition hearing, it becomes clear that the basis for the court's finding that the need for confinement outweighs the policies favoring probation is based, one, on the fact that it's necessary to protect the public from further criminal activity. That is, appellant is an untreated sex offender who's committed a sex offense. He's before the court on his second probation violation. And also, the court finds that it would unduly depreciate the seriousness of the violation if probation were not revoked. And I think that's particularly significant here because the court notes earlier in the hearing that this was a presumptive commitment to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections. And this court has recognized that the fact that the defendant has been placed on probation simply by means of a departure is a significant factor in the calculus when determining whether the need for confinement outweighs the policies favoring probation. As I argued in my brief, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has already weighed that analysis for this particular offense with this particular criminal history. And that has to be a substantial factor here.
So are you saying that referencing its previous departure is really enough to satisfy the kind of third Austin factor? Because one could read this transcript as saying that's really all that happened here.
Well, and I think this, I'm trying to look at my brief to find the exact case, but I think there's a precedential opinion from this court that suggests as much.
But Mr. Smith, isn't that contrary to all the other case law that clearly lays out the Austin and Motlin rules that the district court has to lay out the reasons? All I see here, I don't see really anything in the order, and we have to go to the transcript to find a reference to that. And that reference only parrots the language from the Motlin subfactors, but it doesn't provide an explanation. And there's a plethora of case law that says the district court has to provide that explanation so we can properly review. And it's not our job to scour the record to try to find support for it. The district court has to affirmatively lay out the reasons and explain why one or more of those Motlin subfactors are met. And I just don't see that. I don't see that here at all.
Your Honor, and again, I recognize that it's not in the exact same place in the transcript where the district court says that I find that the need for confinement outweighs the policies favoring probation and that it would unduly depreciate the seriousness of the violation. But I would direct the court's attention to the bottom of page 19 and the top of page 20 in the transcript of the disposition hearing. And it's important, I think, to understand why it's not in the written order finding that the defendant has violated probation, because the district court at that point in time hadn't decided to revoke probation. It had simply found that there had been a violation. So it's only after a contested disposition hearing that the district court is making its findings regarding revocation of probation. And I think both this court and the Supreme Court have recognized that making the findings on the record, which is later reduced to a transcript, is adequate to satisfy Austin and Motlin's requirements that those findings be made in writing. So, but the district court says you were given an opportunity to stay out of prison while you were on probation. You were given that opportunity. You were given another opportunity when you came back in for drinking. And now you were given another opportunity to complete treatment that you didn't do. And based on that evidence that's been presented, I'm confident you knew what you needed to do to complete treatment. And you didn't do it. And that, I think, is it's clear, even though the district court doesn't say right there that those are the facts that lead it to conclude that the need for confinement outweighs the policies favoring probation, and, or that it would unduly depreciate the seriousness of the violation.
But I think that,
it's abundantly clear.
But Mr. Smith, that almost seems to go to the first Austin factor of there being a violation. What did he do? What was the condition that had been violated? And the fact that it's completely separate from the third Austin factor analysis and the Motlin subfactors, how it seems like we're trying to piecemeal the district court's analysis to try to find support for it, and that's not our role. And we're actually, case law says we're not supposed to be doing that unless the district court clearly lays it out for us. We're not supposed to be, like I said, scouring the record to try to find support for the district court's ultimate determination.
So two things on that, Your Honor. One, I think the same operative facts can be relevant to each of the Motlin subfactors and each of the Austin factors. The other thing is the question of the first part of that is the most relevant to the whether the policies favoring probation are outweighed. And that's the history of violations, the fact that there had been an interim probation violation and sanction. I wish the district court had been a little more clear about that on the record, but I think it did make an adequate record. I see my time has expired. I would simply ask the court to affirm the revocation of appellant's probation. Thank you.
Are there other questions from the panel? Seeing none, we'll turn to you, Mr. Berkowitz, for the last word.
Thank you. I think it's important, as this court's seemingly, and I haven't really had a chance to argue on the remaining Austin factors about what was really available and what was Mr. Berg able and willing to do and how the district court, I think the district, actually I had to interrupt the district courts. I think it's my first time in a sentencing order where the district court in that transcript seemed to kind of disregard and sentence Mr. Berg based on, I believe he was upset at him because he had given him a chance and didn't want to see him back. And then didn't want to discuss treatment, didn't want to discuss alpha emergence. In fact, I had to interrupt the court and we had an interesting discussion where I asked the court then to colloquy Neil Johnson, where I said, wait a minute, the court seemed to indicate, it's actually contrary to all that Mr. Smith indicated, that there was some sort of balancing of treatment. That actually didn't happen. In fact, the district court in the transcript seemed to say, well, if you had enrolled in alpha emergence earlier, I wouldn't be violating you. That's what was indicated by the trial court. And I explained to the court, well, I wasn't his lawyer and he didn't know he had the opportunity. So I asked Neil Johnson, the probation agent, well, wait a minute. Did you tell him that he could enroll in treatment? And Neil Johnson, the probation agent, actually had very good things to say about Mr. Berg. He was compliant, cooperative, communicative, and that he didn't have any issues with Mr. Berg, only that he was violating on this letter solely. And then when I brought it to Mr. Johnson's attention, well, do you have any problems with alpha emergence? No, I don't. But it's not his practice, once there's a violation letter, to allow another probationer to re-enroll until it's resolved. I think that's logical. But it wasn't because Mr. Berg didn't want to or intend to enroll. He didn't know he could until I told him we're going to do it. And then once he did it, while we contested the violation and I brought alpha emergence in, then he's like, well, I guess we could do it. But the district court then just seemed to go sideways and say, well, because you didn't enroll soon enough, I may not have violated you. That was seemingly indicated. So that would actually provide the opposite analysis if the court were to look at the transcript, that the district court, in fact, intentionally refused to consider or could have considered or might actually change its mind on remand. And I think because the district court and the transcript provides highly different a possible analysis by the district court. If it were to get some guidance from this court as to, well, was it intentional and willful? And I actually don't think it's legally relevant, but the district court seemed to think that conduct after a violation letter seemingly impacts the Austin factors, that it's somehow more of a violation after the fact that he didn't re-enroll when he didn't know he could after the May violation prior to sentencing in October and November. That should give this court some great pause as to the district court's intentions and its underlying logic and findings in this case, because why would it in fact need to go to those facts it shouldn't legally have considered in sentencing Mr. Berg to prison on an emotional basis that, yep, I'm going to then go back and say, I gave you a chance. That is not a consideration of the Austin factors. That is, I believe, an intentional and willful statement by the district court to use non-lawful factors, which would be a resolved probation violation, to then discuss now why he needs to go to prison for this violation, unrelated to alcohol and drinking. That's of great concern, I think, for this court when it reviews the Austin factors about whether or not a re-enrollment into probation is a possibility, about whether that treatment program that may better fit Mr. Berg is a reasonable option in lieu of confinement. There's nothing in the record that Mr. Berg is dangerous, as opposing counsel admits. He is not having contact with minors. This was a relationship issue with his prior partner with alcohol. This is not a predatory issue with children. He is not out in the public having problem and having contact. He is not doing any dangerous actions, activities. He's not engaged in new crimes at all. Yes, he did admit to this one alcohol incident, and that is something he needs to work on and should sway in favor of the Austin factors that he didn't have another drinking violation. So we have a one-time issue with treatment that actually got started 2 years late, from 2018 until 2020. And now he's on it for 5 of the 27 months that he's able to, and he gets kicked off for not dealing with, I would suggest, a highly psychological, difficult proposition for any human being of any intelligence level, of which Mr. Berg does not seemingly have a high one, which is, when do I adequately admit? When am I making progress when I had an Orgard plea? How do I reconcile this in my mind when I took this plea deal? And how do I reconcile that in my ongoing treatment? That's something the district court needs to weigh and should weigh, and it should reverse and remand.
The court thanks you both for the helpful argument and briefing. We'll take